This is Alan Minsky, and the show is Building a Powerful Left, live from the Left Forum in New York City. Maria Armudian will be back next week, Sunday at noon on KPFK. To open the show today, we're going to break away a little bit from the Building a Powerful Left in the United States format, as we'll be talking to Ayman Mohedin of Al Jazeera about Libya, and then Ahmed Shakti about the crisis in Libya as well. Then we'll return to the Building a Powerful Left format, and we'll be talking with Benjamin Barber, Saskia Sassen, Mark Brenner from Labor Notes, and radical cartoonist Ted Rall, all from the Left Forum here in New York City. But first, two short dialogues on the crisis in Libya. This is Alan Minsky, live from the Left Forum in New York City, and I'm here with Ayman Mohedin with Al Jazeera. And your thoughts on what's taking place in Libya and how, with the intervention of a military force from the Western nations, and how that may significantly transform, or does it instantly transform, what's been taking place in the Middle East over the last 2 months, from Tunisia through Egypt, popular uprisings, no Western intervention, now Western intervention.
Well, I think the situation in Libya is very concerning. It's very dire on many fronts, on a humanitarian front, on a political front. There's no doubt that the events in Libya are different than what we've seen in Tunisia and in Egypt. And they may have begun by similar catalysts, but they're definitely now moving in very different directions. I think the fact that the Arab world and so many people around the world are so nervous about Western intervention in Libya is a testament to really how much the West has lost credibility in the eyes of the Arab world. Because the fact that even best case scenario, let's say that the West is intervening in Libya with genuine intentions to protect the Libyan people and to actually safeguard the lives of Libyan people, the fact is that that is not resonating with people in the Arab world, because the credibility of the West after years of military domination, military intervention, is really being lost on the people there. That's one. Two, I think there's definitely going to be questions about the future of Libya's oil. Libya is a country that has vast amounts of resources, and I think that most discerning people will ask questions about whether or not the motivation to help the people of Libya, so-called, quote, help the people of Libya, is because there could be a huge financial and economic incentive waiting down at the end of the road. We can say that the one consistent act by the West in all of these revolutions is that it has been very slow in any position it has taken to side on the side of the people. So even in Tunisia, even in the Egyptian Revolution, the government did not come out, the United States government and others, did not come out to quickly embrace the people's revolt and say that the people should be the ones governing themselves. And the same thing is what we're seeing with Libya. Now, it's manifested itself in a different form through the use of military weapons, but definitely, in principle, it is still coming very late in the eyes of ordinary people.
And one final question. The Arab League has just come out with a statement condemning the threat to civilians while not condemning the action itself. The sense of whether there could be, are you anticipating that there'll be widespread expressions of disapproval across the Arab Middle East over the Western intervention in Libya?
I don't think the Arab League represents the will of the Arab people. It represents the will of the regimes of the Arab world. Right. That's one. So two, I don't think that it has the pulse of the street. The Arab League has in itself contradicted itself many times with demands for a no-fly zone, which it can't impose, then saying no foreign military intervention, then asking for the fly zone that could only be imposed by foreign military intervention because no Arab League country is going to actually impose it. That's one. Two, I think that because the West has for decades abused its power in the Middle East, in the eyes of ordinary Arabs, that when they're trying to do something good, hypothetically, I'm assuming here, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, they are doing something good in Libya to protect the Libyan people. But because in the eyes of the Arab world, they have lost that credibility, they essentially have spent all their currency. People look at what's happened in Iraq. People look at the policies of Israel backed by America towards the Palestinians. They look at policies in Afghanistan. And they really question the motivations behind Western countries. I think that now what has emerged is that the Arab street is aware the foreign policy of Western countries is driven by interests, not by values. And in this particular incident in Libya, the alignment of interests is why there's military intervention. I think that it would be sad to necessarily think that Western foreign policy or Western intervention in the Arab world is driven by ideals and is driven by values. We've seen from Tunisia and Egypt where there were solid fundamental ideals and values that should be embraced early on. These countries, the Western countries, stood on the sidelines, did not necessarily advocate these values and ideals early on. And I think that cost them dearly. So I think there's a great deal of skepticism and pessimism about Western military intervention in Libya. Not to say that in this particular incident, the Western military intervention is not going to help the Libyans. But if the West wants to regain some credibility, it must prove that this military intervention is short-term. It's not going to be long. It will not result in so-called boots on the ground. And their incentive at the end of the day is not going to be to control Libya's vast amounts of oil.
Ayman Mohaldeen from Al Jazeera, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure.
I'm now speaking with Ahmed Shakti, who is an editor with Haymarket Books and a contributor to the International Socialist Review. And Ahmed Shakti was in Tahrir Square in Egypt during the popular uprising there. But today we're going to talk about Libya. And first off, the Western intervention in Libya, the military intervention in Libya, do you feel that this is a sort of game changer? Could it be a game changer in terms of the popular uprisings that have been taking place across North Africa and the Arab Middle East?
Yes, I think that the military intervention that's taking place by Western powers, well, started initially by France before an agreement between them, which should raise some eyebrows as to the motivations of the various forces involved, could be a game changer. The way that I would just step back and try to conceptualize what's been taking place is that we saw, beginning in December of last year, so that would be December 2010, a movement sparked by the self-immolation of a young man in Tunisia that led to an outpouring of rage, anger, bringing together widespread opposition to a 23-year-long dictatorship. That then gave confidence to a similar kind of mobilization to develop in a much bigger Arab country, that is Egypt, bypassing Libya for the time being. During that entire period, the Western powers stood behind the dictators that they'd helped sustain and keep in power, and talked not about the need for the popular uprisings to succeed, but rather about orderly transition. So as that movement spread into Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, and threatens, in my opinion, what is most important to the U.S., which is its own military bases, Saudi Arabia, and the nexus of interest that have been built up over a period of 50 years, and the fact that Libya supplies 70% of oil for Europe, that is what brought the attention of the Western powers, how to stall or forestall these popular risings, which threatened some of the oldest dictatorships in the region. The fact that Muammar Gaddafi drew a line in the sand pretty much has George Bush's old line on what this is all about, which is that people have poisoned the water supply of Libya with PCP or LSD, and that this is the work of Al-Qaeda. So that you have the bizarre situation of a military dictator in for 41 years, who's had a past that we can discuss and talk about, clinging on to power, claiming that this is the work of Al-Qaeda and that really he is in the forefront of the war on terror, only to have sections of his regime peel away from him. Because as the popular rising emerged in Libya, what was fascinating in the early days was that whole sections of his own regime voted with their feet by saying, we cut our losses now. They had understood from Tunisia and Egypt that if you don't cut your losses, you may be lost with the head of the regime. He, on the other hand, turned the Air Force onto his own people and basically said, unlike the other two, that is Ben Ali in Tunisia, Hosni Mubarak, I control the main body of the armed forces and the security apparatus, and I will drown the country in blood. The Western powers are now using that as the cloak for an intervention, which I think is designed to make military intervention in the region palatable in world opinion, and to try to forestall the process that has been going on.
The general series, that this is sort of a special segment in this series on the crisis in Libya, but the series is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. And just quickly, your reflections on what you feel the left in the United States could and should learn from the uprisings in North Africa and across the Arab Middle East of the past few months.
I think that, first of all, the the most important thing that we could and should learn, and I think that a lot of people have learned already, is that it's possible to change things and possible for people, ordinary people, to have a tremendous impact on the direction of politics, on how their lives go. You know, I have a 15-year-old son, and he's now seen a couple of dictatorships fall. He now thinks, why don't we do something like that here when we want to get some change? And what he means is, you know, what we saw in Madison, which, of course, is not, can't be measured quite in the scale of Egypt, but it was clear to people who occupied the state capital in Madison, you could see that it was clear by the signs they held, you know, Hosni Walker, in referring to the governor, who wants to shove something down people's throats, take away collective bargaining, and people who voted for him, finding themselves now saying, wait a minute, I didn't vote for this. I voted for something else, and people beginning to come together to talk about their interests, how to change things, how to discuss things. And anybody who went to the state capitol, whom I've talked to, described effectively what was going on in Tahrir, which is people were abuzz with ideas and solidarity and beginning, oh, you're just like me too, and breaking down the kind of atomized society that I think that we live in the United States, and brought back a sense that it's possible to unite with others around common cause and actually have some effect. I think that's the most important lesson to draw.
Ahmed Shaki, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you again.
This is Building a Powerful Left in the United States, live from the Left Forum. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm here with Benjamin Barber. Benjamin Barber is the author of the classic Strong Democracy, another classic, Jihad versus McWorld, and his most recent book is Consumed. I'm going to just toss to you, since you know you've reflected on these matters for a long time, the past few decades, and the United States has been thrown into the global economic crisis. The middle class is being pulled apart. We have greater wealth disparity than we've ever had before. In many respects, this is sort of a classic scenario where a left could form and become very attractive to the general population. Maybe there's some signs of that coming out of Wisconsin, for instance, but generally not really the case. A lot of dismay with Obama among progressives. Do you think, given this framing, that a stronger left could emerge? And if so, how do you think that could happen? And if not, what do you think the barriers are to it?
I think we could see the emergence of a stronger left, but I think the greatest single obstacle to this, and we were talking about that today in the forum, is the parochialism of the left. The fact that democracy and social movements have been largely captured inside nation states and therefore take place within nation states in a world that is increasingly interdependent and global, and where almost all of the challenges, whether it's ecological challenges or pandemics or terrorism or predatory markets or banks, where all of those challenges are interdependent and across borders, but democracy continues to be about electing leaders or developing social movements within nation states. So one of the questions is, can we begin to respond in an interdependent fashion across borders and not just talk about, for example, the problem of manufacturing jobs in the United States? That's a perfect example of a sort of zero-sum game in which some union folks appear to think that the best way to respond to the globalization of markets is to bring back manufacturing jobs to the United States, maybe by protectionism, maybe by higher tariffs, but in ways that would take those jobs back from places where they currently have gone, on the one hand, in search of lower wages, but on the other hand, in terms of people who live in those places and get those wages, a jump forward in their own living standards and ability for them to be part of a global market. So, to put it simply, we live in an interdependent world whose challenges are all global, and we're responding on the left with social movements and electoral politics and union and collective bargaining politics that are largely American, that are largely domestic, that are largely local. And that means it's going to be very hard, even if you jumpstart through Madison, Wisconsin, and the other challenges to public unions in America, if you jumpstart a sense of reinvigoration on the left, it's going to happen inside the parochial confines of the United States. And even if it succeeds, it's likely to not be very effective, and more importantly, is probably less likely to succeed because it's going to pit an American working class against a Japanese or Mexican or a Indonesian working class, and it's going to ignore realities that the right, that capitalism already recognizes, which is the interdependence of the world. And for that reason, my own work right now is really about trying to focus on interdependence, cross-border solutions, and begin to think about how you can detach democracy from its long nest and home in the nation state, where it was very comfortable, and where the idea of independence was crucial to being democratic, and beginning to understand that democracy today has to ally itself with the notion of interdependence, work across borders the way corporations do, work across borders the way markets do, work across borders the way terrorists do, and begin to create a constructive, positive, and affirmative interdependence. To put it in a word, we either globalize democracy or democratize globalization, or democracy becomes increasingly irrelevant to the global challenges that those of us who care about social justice, equality, and democracy face.
One quick question, maybe a difficult answer, though. Do you envision a way anytime in the not-too-distant future, so we're talking half-decade, decade, 2 decades, where such strategies could re-strengthen the middle class that was established in Western Europe and in the United States, in the industrialized economies in the post-World War II period? Because across those societies, I think the middle class, once the strong foundation of the society, seems almost to be dissipating.
Well, two quick answers. Yes, I do see that's possible, but it's going to be hard. And the reason it's hard is that the whole notion of a middle class has been widely accepted when, in fact, it's socioeconomically, you know, simply inappropriate. 90% of Americans call themselves middle class, including a lot of poor people, a lot of unemployed people, and a number of rich people call themselves middle class because they don't want to be seen as different. You know, the fact is, in reality, there are 40 or 50 million Americans who are genuinely poor. Many of them are children, some are women. There are another 50 million who probably make less than $40,000 a year and who are in no meaningful sense middle class, but most of whom see themselves as middle class. We have a president today who's a liberal Democrat who talks about the middle class all the time. He never talks about the poor. He never talks about, you know, people who are exploited and who are victims and so on, and is, or people of color, though he is a man of color. And the result is that the middle class, the reason the middle class is losing the war is because they've accepted this label of middle class, which makes them supposedly affiliated with those who are successful, with capitalism, with corporations that are actually exploiting them. So the first thing maybe we need to do, both within the United States and across the world, is understand that there is no happy middle class that is mostly a winner in what's going on, but there continue to be people who are exploited by, victims of, and not sharing in the productivity of global capitalism, and those who are, and that when those who don't share in the productivity and the benefits don't recognize that, they become part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
And I'll say thank you. And just to summarize then what you're saying, as we mosey back to the crowd here at the Left Forum in New York City, is that you're saying that we have to, in other words, get the maturity to recognize that this is now an international, interconnected world, and that prosperity for the balance of the population has to be worked out given that, and not
with. That's exactly what I'm saying. And for more on that, if you go to interdependencemovement.org, you can find a lot about actually a global movement that is talking about social justice through the lens of interdependence.
Benjamin Barber, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
This is Alan Minsky live at the Left Forum in New York City, and the series is Building a Powerful Left. And I'm joined now by Saskia Sassen. Saskia Sassen is one of the world's leading commentators and researchers on urbanization and urban spaces. And I became familiar with her work about a decade and a half ago. And I remember at the time that Michael Hart and Antonio Negri had a book called Empire, that there was a lot of discourse and dialogue about the structure of global capitalism. In many respects, for the global left, that book was associated with the counter-globalization movement, which really moved to the back burner in the United States in terms of the radical left. After September 11th, the focus became upon the Bush-era imperial wars. But Saskia Sassen's work that I became familiar with then really illuminated a lot of the thinking that was going on about the structures of modern capitalism as it focused on the development of metropolitan areas that were really the focal points of global capitalism. And again, the thought was very subtle, but very illuminating about the real world we live in and about economy, how people survive in the global economy, where people are moving to, what those spaces look like. So at the Left Forum 2011, maybe the way to start, because it is complex stuff. It's not the basic stuff of let's get out in the streets, have a demonstration, and build the left. What were you speaking on here at the Left Forum, Saskia Sassen?
Well, we had a first panel. I did two panels, but a first panel was on the question, does urban space make a difference for organizing? And on the panel, which I organized, was the woman Ai-Jen Po, who is the founder and organizer of Domestic Workers in New York, who got an ordinance, a kind of a law, a local law passed, giving rights to domestic workers. Another one was Emily Caruana, who works on solidarity politics. And then we had David Harvey and Rami Nashashibi, who organizes Palestinian unemployed adolescents in the South Side ghetto of Chicago and has put them together with African-American Muslims, mostly gang members. So very interesting organizers. In all three cases of these organizers, what came out was that the space of the city actually matters for organizing. Now, we know from the Cairo issues, the Tahrir Square, how important it was to have that huge square where millions of people can gather. That matters. And it makes me think, by the way, this is a footnote, that in the future, despotic governments will not want to have such huge squares, you know. Like, we have already also blocked our old, like, Union Square Park, remember? It was a space where, you know, certain things could happen. Now it's so pretty and busy that you can't. Same thing with Times Square. So the issue is that there are certain spaces, and this is sort of my version of it, that enable the powerless, not necessarily to gain power, but they enable their powerlessness to become complex. And in that complexity lies the possibility of making history, of making politics. So back to Cairo and the Tahrir Square. It's not that they gained power in those weeks, you know, that they were organizing, but they were not simply elementary, powerless actors. You know, and so there is something about urban space. The woman who organized domestic workers said that 200,000 domestic workers, you know, women, basically come into the city every morning to be the carers of old people, of children, the cleaners, etc. And the possibility of organizing this widely dispersed, each one is in an individual home, the possibility of organizing these people seems almost impossible. And that has been the typical line. Well, she took it a step further. She went to the doormen of all the high-end buildings in Manhattan and said, look, you have to help us. You have to support us. And the doormen, basically, the doormen's union in New York City worked with them, and they began to actually be able. Now, it took years to organize, but now there is, you know, a formal status. There is an ordinance. Now, these are just micro examples of how a certain kind of space enables those who do not have a lot of power to actually make history, you know, and to gain a bit of power. But they're not necessarily fully empowered. You know, I want to get away from this notion, okay, so you don't have power, the only difference is going to be you're empowered. No, there is an in-between space.
So much to comment off of that. And, of course, Madison, Wisconsin, the State House, Tahrir Square, there's similarity there. Obviously, Cairo, though, like Paris or even London, maybe a city with less of a history of that kind of revolutionary activism than, say, Paris and now Cairo. Because I think in the history of London, we've never seen anything like Tahrir Square. But those are both the central dominant cities in terms of finance and economy in those countries, and also the national capital. Paris combines, of course, it also being the student capital of that country. The United States has two capitals. It has New York City, as Washington, D.C., in Chicago, Los Angeles, these huge metropoles. Now, this will initially be broadcast on Southern California Radio for a Los Angeles audience. Los Angeles has, of course, you know, as the 20th century developed, sort of introduced to the world a new model of spatial dispersion that really creates huge challenges to be noticed in terms of the classical strategy of collecting a crowd and having the public pay attention because there's a huge crowd. And maybe comment a little bit about that in the broader question of the challenges within America, which really, in terms of a prosperous, powerful, well, actually globally dominant political power is so dispersed with suburbia, a population so dispersed, how people form bonds of social solidarity, and what your work has said about the United States in that regard.
Well, look, you touch on a critical issue, which is that there is something about the American condition, the suburbs, you know, the spatial distribution, also the size. It's a huge country. I always say it's far too big, especially when I'm coming from the West Coast to the East Coast. I think it's just too big a country, frankly, you know. But the other issue is, and I don't know which one is more important, you know, I must say, is that we have become consumers, consumers of our citizenship, consumers of our democracy, consumers of our rights. But all of those democracy rights, they need to be made. And then the question is to make. Those people in Tahrir Square, the people in Wisconsin, they were not consumers of their citizenship. They were making their citizenship. They were enacting the project of citizenship, the project of claim making. They were demanding. Now, then the question is, are there certain situations where it is easier to become actors rather than simply consumers? And so I do think that there are. And Wisconsin, you know, Madison, it's a very peculiar space because it's totally divided between right-wing and a very active left-wing. A huge university population. It has this huge space where they can gather. You know, not all American cities of that size have that, which I think is extremely interesting. Now, you spoke about Los Angeles, and I agree with everything you said. I do think that what happened in Los Angeles is a kind of a trajectory. So at the beginning, you could talk about just pure oppression almost, except the time, you know, when black workers, for instance, were employed in the aircraft industry and they had good jobs, you know, there was a sense of that. But in a way, the dominant populations we think of are immigrants, many undocumented. So it's interesting to see who organized. Well, you know, there was. I remember being in Los Angeles. I taught at UCLA for a while in 1982. And I joined an organization that was also aiming at organizing domestic work. It was called like Home Workers Association, something like that. And the Justice for Janitors also. Right? For all I know, they started there. But they were significant there. And that was 82. Now, Justice for Janitors has succeeded now in the last 10 years to organize, you know, the center of cities in Boston, in New York, in Chicago. They have moved to, they were invited by the big Service Workers Association in London to organize the city of London. They really have concentrated on central areas, you know, not suburbs, Justice for Janitors. And then they were invited by the big Metal Workers Union in Germany, who also handles janitors and all of that kind of stuff in a city like Frankfurt. Then they moved on to Amsterdam. So clearly these people who start, and I think Justice for Janitors also started in Los Angeles, by yes. Latinos. Mm-hmm. Right. And they have a tradition of thinking, organizing, etc. Now what do you see? At some point you have so many Latinos living in L.A., that there are certain spaces where organizing happens, but then the rest becomes more like community. How do you make your community survive rather than going out there and confronting power? But, for instance, the Salvadoran woman who was very, very short, who organized the street vendors in L.A., I got to know her. And, again, it took years, like with Domestic Workers Union here in New York City. Years! But, you know, you don't give up because you are making something. You know, this notion of trajectories. So I am talking now about a whole bunch of situations which have one thing in common. They are not very powerful actors. They are not members of a strong union. But they choose their space. They choose their strategy. You know, like the Justice for Janitors had a strategy. It does not organize all janitors. No. You organize in the centers of power, the luxury buildings, etc., etc. And they have succeeded. But the third observation is that it took a lot of time. So, you know, it is very difficult to organize in the United States. And we're frankly losing the battles on the traditional unions. Right? Not the new kinds of unions, but the traditional unions. However, now I want to say just a bit more on Los Angeles. And I think that Los Angeles, in a way, the ghetto, the the site where all the Latinos were concentrated, they become the spaces where you have a kind of organizing that is invisible because it does not involve a negotiation with power. It is more a kind of upgrading of their living space, you know, the community space. So individual home renewal becomes neighborhood upgrading, setting up shops, developing a sub-economy. And that is also an American way. So you exit some sort of space, an intermediate zone where you confront power. You exit that. And you just focus on your neighborhood. I think that has been part of the history of this country, too. Now, that does diffuse the organizing humph, you know? And it can then allow a lot of brilliant lefty commentators to say, there's no organizing happening in this country. But you know, there is. It's just not, it's a different kind of organizing, and it does not confront power, and that's a problem. Just as progenitors did. But you know, a lot of what happens in the immigrant community is a bit self-contained, but it's quite a bit of organizing that happens there.
I suppose one final, though, general question, which is, if you do look at a direct confrontation with power in the United States, because, you know, left movements do have a history in the United States, and certainly, I think to most people's minds, the period of the 60s and 70s, maybe some people look back at that and say, well, wow, what was that all about even? Obviously, the Vietnam War, the civil rights movements, but in terms of confronting American economic power, not all that much substantive came out of it. But then you go back to the 30s, and very significant because of the parallels with the economic crisis now coming out of Lower Manhattan, the financial crash sparking a great recession here and a great depression then. Took a while. Unions built up, and it became a direct confrontation with power, and then the compromise of the Roosevelt and then post-Roosevelt years with capital. The United States certainly represents a real challenge as it has developed with the majority of the population living in suburbia, the amount of television, which, you know, obviously I'm working on Pacifica Radio. It's more or less pro-corporate propaganda gets pounded into people's minds and hearts through that. Not quite sure how that technology will evolve over the next few years with the internet, but probably be rest assured the powers that control the American media will probably control what's consumed off of whatever screen people are interfacing with in the coming years. And so it's very hard to build a left. And I suppose the general final question is, if you're talking about building such a left, and I think you're right, it's organizing going around all across the United States in communities and sometimes seems invisible. But at the same time, the general ideas that animate a traditional left, that society's wealth should be shared, that people should live cooperatively, not competitively, there's ways of organizing the macro society in those ways. And these are direct confrontations with power. How important is the spatial organization of the United States that leftists really need to focus on if they're going to make any headway in that kind of confrontation with power?
Well, a couple of things. In terms of the spatial organization of the United States, it's a question of using spaces. So you have lots of cities. You have lots of central spaces. You know, Wisconsin, Madison is not the only one. And so the notion is more a networked, multi-sided politics. The issue that is more difficult, and you said it yourself, is this notion of some sort of really organized common front. Because in that multi-sited possibility, all these cities with all the little centers and all the people, there is also the potential of weakness. I think that you need another step to really create a strong national left that can confront the federal government, you know, that can confront the capital, corporate capital world. And there, I think it's just very difficult, not only in the United States, mind you, it is difficult in all countries. And there is something about capital. Capital is no longer a bourgeoisie. Capital is no longer a bourgeoisie, you know, which lived in a certain city. The city was a space for representation. You could sort of confront it. Citicorp is owned 40% by sovereign wealth funds, mostly from the Gulf area. You know, I mean, it barely is an American bank. So the whole notion of confronting capitalists, right? Now, the federal government is a different matter. Now, you go back to the past, we have glorious histories of organizing with enormous courage. You know, the Wobblies, remember? I mean, you know. And I think the 60s was a very interesting, and then, of course, the civil rights movement, which went on for generations. And it is because you had those generations of struggle that in the end, in 1964, one good day, the legislature said, okay, let's give them some rights. You know, in high school books, I think very often it looks like it was the liberalism of the legislature in the 60s. No, it was struggle. So my question, and I don't have an answer, is today, how do we combine this possibility of multi-sited using certain spaces, especially cities, of course, with really a national strategy where you go against the federal government?
Saskia Sassen, again, thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left, live from the Left Forum in New York City.
My pleasure. It was great.
Thank you.
And we're here again on the red carpet outside of the Verso Books event, Friday night of the Left Forum here in New York City, here in Brooklyn, in Dumbo. And I'm speaking with Mark Brenner. He is the director of Labor Notes. And Mark, the situation could not be, the table could not be more set for the emergence of a left in the United States. The middle class is being pulled apart. We have wealth inequality. With each passing year, it's worse than the last, making it the worst we've seen in our lifetime. Yet there is no powerful, socially transformative left in this country. It's a difficult question. It's a difficult project. On any given day, it may seem impossible. How do you think we could build a powerful left in the United States?
Well, you know, I spend most of my time thinking about and working with folks in the, you know, organized labor movement and in and around worker struggles. And I think the prospects are better than they've ever been for actually building a bridge between the working class in this country and the left. You know, I look at what's happening in Wisconsin, and, you know, I was just there last weekend, and it was amazing. You see people who look like they should be at a Tea Party rally, who are actually out fighting for their rights. They're occupying the state house, you know, 2 weeks shutting down the state government. It's really, for me at least, the seeds of the kind of movement that I want us to build. You know, of course, what it's going to require on our part, the folks in the labor movement who have connections to the left, who think about bigger questions, the issues you were raising at the top here, I think it requires us to really shake off some of the timidity that we've had, to really figure out ways to bridge the big questions about how our society works, why the economy is serving up such misery for so many people, and what it would take to change it. I think our formula for so long has really been a shackle for us. It's be reasonable, you know, find the outer limit of the political possibilities in whatever budget cycle or whatever electoral cycle and try to push to that end. And I think that, you know, now being reasonable is our enemy. I think we need to demand the impossible. It's really a moment to be raising things like, why is it that there are billionaires in the state of Wisconsin that are paying less taxes than people that are making $25,000 a year? Why is it that some of the richest manufacturing companies in America are just raking in the profits and they're essentially driving their workers into the poorhouse so they can make another buck? It's got to stop. And I think the situation there and in Ohio and in Michigan is getting to a point where there's space in the labor movement to raise some of these questions to really try to push the envelope. I think it's up to us, the folks who are in the trenches every day, to try to actually figure out strategies and actually engage a much more muscular kind of program than we've been doing. So that's our challenge, figuring out a way to build that bridge between the ideas and the actual values of the left and all these hundreds of thousands of people we're seeing in the streets of Madison every weekend.
Your response does, to my mind, beg one central question, okay, which is the structure, both legally and internally, of American labor unions. And legally, post-Taft-Hartley, the structure of labor unions in America, there's pressure for them to only be concerned for the benefits of their rank and file. You know, they're organized, I suppose, all parallel to each other, but not so much together. And on top of that, the labor leadership, with the exception of only a few unions, has not propagated the kind of broader ideas. Do you feel that 70 years after the CIO came of age and the American labor union reached sort of height of its powers in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, that there is an appetite for reconfiguration of the American labor movement?
Well, I think there's no question that We have lived through more than a generation of decline, and a lot of the things that actually inspired people to organize 50, 70 years ago are still there, but the actual audacity to do it, the actual lived experience of doing it, walking off the job in a wildcat strike and not actually getting fired over it, that experience is largely missing from this moment. I think that's why, in some sense, what's happening in Madison is so important, because it's really raising both the actual opportunity and experience, in some cases, of doing these things. I mean, there's no question that if we're going to actually turn around the situation for workers in this country, it's going to require us to break the law. It's going to require us to think about things much, much bigger than, can we actually keep our individual health care plan with our employer negotiated in such a way that we pay, you know, less than 5% of the costs. We're going to have to actually grapple with things like, why in the richest country in the history of humanity are there 51 million people that don't have any health care? And why is it that we're actually living with a situation where our health care costs are going up 10, 15, 20% a year, and we're the ones having to deal with that? Yet, you know, the corporations that we work for are making billions. People on Wall Street are making tens of billions every year. The system's stacked against us. And so I think that internally, we have to get away from some of the real lowest common denominator engagements with what do politics in this country mean, and how do we understand why things happen the way that they do, and how does the economy work? I think that we really have, because in part of the legacy of McCarthy, because in part of the accepted wisdom that people in this country are fairly conservative politically, you know, that the center, you know, middle America is a fairly conservative place to be, that we can't actually talk about what I would consider to be actually incredibly enticing ideas. Single-payer health care, whether it's expanding Social Security or talking about it as a new system, talking about programs to provide free higher education. And I think the labor movement is also caught in, you know, they're victims of their own success. We've won certain things, and now we're really preoccupied with defending them, and we're missing the fact that as those gains erode and erode and erode, sometimes it's going to take a leap of faith for something much bigger, much more audacious to actually get us something different, something better.
Obviously, the future is unwritten. No one can say how ideas will even play out in the future, but at a certain point, they have to be positive. And I don't know how many Americans out there realize, because they see the French general strikes that happen, and all of French society in Paris gets shut down for 3 days at a time. France has a lower private sector unionization rate than the United States of America, but what they don't have is a Taft-Hartley law. I'm wondering if we need some labor martyrs, going back to earlier in American history, we had labor martyrs around Taft-Hartley. And not even people who are going to get, you know, killed by Pinkertons, but people who are going to go to jail for going on strike in solidarity from a different trade union. Because that's what Taft-Hartley outlaws, right? You can have people who will go on strike when they're fighting a contract in their particular trade union. You can't have solidarity strikes, so the Teamsters can't go on strike when the auto workers are on strike, right? With what you saw in Madison, again, do you think it's conceivable that we might actually see some movement where people realize that in order to have strong unions in this country, Taft-Hartley has to be addressed, and the only way it can be addressed, given the configuration of the elected officials in this country, would be by workers and unionized workers taking such a bold action?
Well, I definitely think that we're going to have to break the law to change the law, and I think that we're going to have to do things that people didn't imagine, you know, 6 weeks ago that they were going to be able or capable of doing. In order to get where we need to go. But I guess I wouldn't frame it as a sort of a challenge to Taft-Hartley. I would frame it much more as a challenge to the economic system that we're living in, which has essentially got the best case scenario, we're running on a gerbil wheel to stand in place. Worst case scenario, we're losing ground every day in a struggle to kind of keep our heads above water. So I think that for me, what we're really struggling with, whether it's in Madison or Ohio, California, is how do we actually go out every day and actually fix our sights on a target that people see as ambitious, but also something they can imagine doing. Because, you know, I think that it's that stretching our capacity that actually leads us into a space where we can actually begin to imagine doing things like you're describing. There's no question. I want to just highlight what you said about going to jail. You know, you were talking about labor margins and people getting killed. I'm absolutely right. I don't think people need to get killed. But we get arrested now, and it's all theater. I mean, you know, you go, you pre-register, you're out in an hour. This is not Martin Luther King sitting in the Birmingham jail here. You know, we need to actually be willing to disrupt the political and economic system that we're in. And what is it going to take to inspire ordinary people to go and consider sitting in a jail cell for 2 weeks over something like what Scott Walker's trying to do in Wisconsin? What is it going to take for people to consider the idea that in a machine tool shop in Racine, it's worth going on strike and risking your contract, which has a no-strike clause or which essentially limits what you can do to your issues, not issues for the rest of the working class in Wisconsin, and saying, screw that, we're going to try it. And I think we've now got tens of thousands of people who've actually got a little taste of that. Teachers walked off the job all over the state. I mean, it was essentially a teacher strike across Wisconsin for 3 days. They're still working. Nobody's getting fired over this. There's definitely a risk. I've heard talk of a couple of people I know who are, you know, at risk of suspension and stuff. So I don't want to minimize the things people are putting on the line here. But the fact that people act and see that they have power is transformative. And we need more and more of those kinds of experiences. The last thing I would say is also we have to be very clear that we're going to lose. We're going to lose a lot. And that's the only way things ever change. I mean, if you look at the civil rights movement, we look back and we say, oh, look at the Montgomery bus boycott. That was transformative. They won. But actually, there were other examples where we did similar activity and we lost. You know, in fact, the history of every social movement is littered with more defeats than it is with successes. But the way we write history is looking back at the success. And it actually does us a disservice. We have to be ready to take it on the chin, to go out there and build leaders, to develop people through these kinds of struggles in a way that actually can lead them to go out and do what it takes to win. Because, you know, you lose and you lose and you lose, and then you win. And that's the breakthrough that we need right now in this country, in this labor movement. Final thing, I think the other opportunity that this really puts us with is not just in Wisconsin, but everywhere. There's so much on the line now for workers and unions in a way that there hasn't been for so long, that the chance to actually start seeing themselves as, you know, part of a much bigger movement, part of a much bigger thing, part of the working class, to put it bluntly, is actually higher than it's ever been. What separates you from a dishwasher in a restaurant? You know, when one day to the next you can lose your job, when one day to the next your benefits disappear, when one day to the next you're essentially transformed in terms of what you can do. I think people are actually opening their eyes to the fact that they're the old question, what side are you on? It's really resonating in a way that it hasn't for a long time for regular rank and file union folk. And that to me gives me a lot of hope that there is this chance to build the kind of working class movement that this country needs.
Mark Brenner, Director of Labor Notes, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the red carpet outside the Verso Books Party in Dumbo, Brooklyn, on the show Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thank you.
The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. We are live in the Left Forum in New York City. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm sitting here with Ted Rall, a nationally syndicated cartoonist, award-winning cartoonist, and the author most recently of An Anti-American Manifesto, where Ted Rall, again, a nationally distributed prominent cartoonist, takes a radical, dare I say, explicitly revolutionary take on the current American social, political, cultural climate. So tell people a little bit about why you decided to write in the book Anti-American Manifesto.
The idea came about in the fall of 2008. We were in the middle of an economic meltdown. The credit markets were seizing up. And the Bush administration, then in its last term, decided to respond to this with the TARP bailout program. When Obama came in, I was shocked that he continued and expanded upon Bush's policies and that he made no move whatsoever to bail out the people who were in so much trouble. I mean, after all, since 2008, over 10 million Americans have lost their homes to foreclosure. We now have 70 million people who are structurally, permanently unemployed. The real unemployment rate is over 20%. And I'm not just for the record here, making an ethical case. I'm making a case of sanity and survival for the Obama administration and the U.S. regime. I found it amazing to contemplate that they would not try to save themselves by greasing the skids, by putting money into the system, by putting money into ordinary people's pockets, just to preserve social and political stability. But they didn't do that. They basically had a big go-to-hell message to everybody who was being fired and thrown out of their homes. And meanwhile, the billions and billions poured into the coffers of multinational banks. Now, at that time, I immediately saw that there was going to be a crisis because we would be entering a time when the system had become so impervious to internal reform, which is not, for example, was not the case in the 60s or in the 30s. In the 30s, we did come to a revolutionary crisis moment, which the system addressed through the New Deal. And even though there was a clash between the ruling elites at the time and many people who were opposed to Roosevelt among them, he won the day and capitalism moved on. Same thing in the 1960s when there was a crisis of capitalism and of cultural mores and forms. The system was able to make enough concessions, for example, in the arena of women's rights, gay rights, etc., to address the concerns of people who were looking for internal reform. But when you have a system that is so beholden to short-term corporate profitability that it can't even save itself by bribing the American people not to overthrow it, you've got a system that's doomed. And that's why I decided to write the Anti-American Manifesto. The system is headed toward collapse. And as things currently stand, the parties in charge that stand to exploit that situation the most effectively are the hard right, the Tea Party, and even to the right of that, the militias, etc. And, of course, groups that have yet to come into existence. But it's the right that's heavily armed, that has been thinking about these issues, has had a very millenarial approach for a long time, as we've seen, for instance, with Glenn Beck and even Rush Limbaugh. So these are the people who I think are really poised to step into the vacuum when the U.S. system goes the way of the Soviet Union. And I wanted to write a cri du cœur that would allow the American people to see that there is a way out. Politics is not something that only happens the second Tuesday of November every 2 to 4 years. Politics is not something that happens between Democrats and Republicans or even Greens and Libertarians. It's actually, real politics don't take place in Washington, D.C. or in the Capitol at all. Real politics is with your neighbors at Starbucks. It's over the water cooler at work. It's at the assembly line. It's at the unemployment office. And that's where revolutionary strategizing and organization is going to take place. And I felt that it was important to make the argument for revolution, and more importantly, for the idea that we can succeed now at this time.
I have two questions. The second question I want to get to is the fertile ground for this kind of response. See, I actually found very compelling in your book, in your work in general, and even a little bit in the panel that I was just sitting in that you were participating at here in the Left Forum, your sort of recognition of, you know, the makeup of contemporary American society. And one thing that I always believe is that, you know, Americans, and the economist Richard Wolff in his very popular essays and talks recently always points out that a big part of the American contract with the population has been that you'll be more prosperous than the previous generation. Americans are suckers for wanting to have a prosperous life where they're well off and there's good education and the best of everything for themselves and everybody, and that's not happening. That's fertile ground for transforming the system so that can again be delivered. But before I get there, I want to ask your thoughts on why it was that the initial response in terms of a populist American political response to the years after the crisis was from the right. Do you think it was just hypnosis from Obama, that the left was just going to give this guy who everybody had so much hope in after the Bush years, or and that may be wearing off now? Or why do you think that the right can mobilize, and does it have something to do with the idiocy of our cultural discourse?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. I mean, we have a mass media that's complicit in right-wing propagandizing to an extreme extent. I mean, today, as we talk, the United States has just begun the invasion of Libya. And, you know, this morning there was a discussion on NPR between two pundits. One was E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. The other one was David Brooks of the New York Times. Mr. Dionne was ostensibly representing the left. Both, of course, are completely in favor of military action. And I was not able to find any mainstream media source that interviewed anyone who was opposed to military action against Libya. I'm sure that they had one or two out there, but just running the dial, you don't find them. So propaganda is strong. Without a doubt, there's a certain cultural illiteracy and a grand tradition of anti-intellectualism in the United States that goes back to the early 19th century, and there's been Susan Jacoby has written about this better than I could ever talk about it. But there's also a tendency, I think, for the best organized groups to naturally step into the breach. And the left has been basically non-existent since 1972 in this country as a militant faction. All we have are progressives and we have liberals, but we have no one who's interested in changing the system wholesale and getting rid of the capitalist system wholesale. And sorry, closing your eyes and wishing doesn't count. You have to actually make it happen yourself. So I think that when it comes to, you know, why this particular moment people turned to Obama, I talk about that extensively in the book. That's actually all part of the grand historical cycle. I mean, if you look at the history of revolution, revolution usually follows and usually marks the end of an attempted liberal reformer who tries to save the system from itself, but cannot. You know, Tsar Nicholas II perhaps was the least good example of that, but certainly King Louis XVI attempted to reform the French monarchy, but it was too little, too late. And Gorbachev with the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s, and you can just sort of look at, it kind of makes revolution, it makes the case for revolution, a guy like Obama, because if you're a progressive or a leftist, you look at Obama and you say, okay, this guy is the best that this system is going to give us. You're never going to get a president who's any smarter or further to the left or more well-intentioned or more progressive or more able to make the kinds of changes that we want. And yet, he makes no changes whatsoever. And, you know, everybody, your listeners know the long litany of Guantanamo staying open and the torture policy continuing and the assassinations and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq continuing and the TARP bailouts and so on and so forth. And it goes on and on and on. In fact, you'd be very hard-pressed to think of any substantial changes that Obama has made. You know, there's window dressing stuff, a few regulations here and there, nips and tucks, some personnel changes, consumer advocate, but not much. So I think that people size that up, and then they look, and then when someone like me comes along and says, look, this system is impervious to reform. Look at Obama. He's been in there for 2 years. He had the biggest majority of that a single party has ever had in 100 years, and he didn't do squat with it. Compare that to what Bush did with his 50-50, or really his 50-49-1 majority in the Senate a few years back. I mean, he ran roughshod with the Democrats. So, you know, you can say the Democrats and Obama and the liberals, they're either bought in and corrupted or they're useless. I don't know which. I don't pretend to know what lives in their soul. All I can judge is the results. And if you're a person who's lost their home or has been unemployed, you know the results. The results are you might have gotten your 99 weeks of unemployment. It's gone. Now you and your family are screwed and you're scared and you know that the system is not going to help you. That's the case that I'm making. I think it's a pretty compelling one.
Ted Ralph, thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States, live from the Left Forum.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank producers Melissa Figueroa and Avriel Hillman. This show began with two short interviews with Ayman Mohyeldeen and Ahmed Shakti about Libya. The version on the website buildingapowerfulleft.org will include a longer version of the interview you just heard a part of with Ted Ralph. That will be up on the website buildingapowerfulleft.org. Within the day. Building a Powerful Left, live from the Left Forum here in New York City. I'm Alan Minsky, and Maria Armudian will be back next week on KPFK at noon.